Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Later in this program, we'll get the latest developments on upcoming U.S. Supreme Court cases. But first, we're going to discuss the media coverage of the recent pivotal election in Argentina. On November 19th, Argentinian voters, to the surprise of many, picked Javier Milei, the far-right libertarian economist-turned-TV personality, as the country's next president. Many experts are predicting a tumultuous and difficult future for the second largest economy in Latin America. The country's already experiencing an ongoing economic meltdown with inflation running at 143% and 40% of the population living in poverty. So to get the latest from Argentina, we're joined by Valen Irizibar, an award-winning journalist, editor at the Buenos Aires Herald, and podcaster specializing in policy, gender-based violence, and LGBTQ issues. So good to have you on the show, Valen.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So Valen, the result of the presidential elections in Argentina made headlines all over the world, mostly because the nature of the candidate, Milei, has often been compared to Trump. He's a far-right economist turned TV presenter who brandished a chainsaw during his rallies as a promissory sign to smash the state. Were there signs that he could win the second round of the runoff that they just had?
I mean, yes and no. I think what was really difficult about this election was just how uncertain everything was. And it was more about not voting the other candidate, if that makes sense. So it wasn't so much I am in favor of Milei or I'm in favor of Massa, the current economy minister who was the opposing candidate. But it was more like I don't want the other guy to win. And in both cases, it just seemed so unlikely that they would win either way, that, you know, and polls in general just being way off the mark kind of is what made it heart-stopping and also just extremely difficult as a journalist to say, you know, what's going on? What can we do with this? But yeah, there were signs for sure, mostly the economy and, you know, the noise that there was around him about his candidacy, right, as an anti-political candidate. And just to, you know, you compare him to Trump. And I think the big difference that I see, at least having lived in the US and been with KLW, by the way, while I was in the US, and Milei, is that Milei is a true outsider. You know, there is a moment where Trump is chosen by the RNC, and that's very much not something that's happened with Milei. So in terms of signs of him winning, it was more like, wow, he's gotten this far. How has he gotten this far? And, you know, we really don't know where he's going to go from here.
Well, it does seem like a pretty critical difference there with Trump. And by the way, welcome back to KLW. It is great to have you back with our station here. So I wanted to ask about who voted for him. I know that he secured over 55% of the vote compared with 44.3% for his rival, the finance minister you just referenced. So who are these people who are deciding to vote for him? What's the general makeup there, if we can generalize?
If we go, first of all, for a more granular level thing we've been seeing in the past, because this was 2 weeks ago now, we're starting to see the numbers come out as to who voted for him. His voting base has, you know, been usually a vast majority of young men, right? Between, I think, sort of 16 and 30 or 35 years old. Overwhelmingly, like almost 70% of his voter base are men of that age bracket. And what's been interesting in the past few days, at least, I've been seeing analyses talking about how he's sort of completely swept everyone under the rug when it comes to security forces and armed forces, people within, this is because of his vice president, Victoria Villarruel, who we can talk about in a bit if you want. But there's a lot of support from the military and people, well, military dictatorship apologists, a lot of self-employed people. You know, there's a base that is sort of well known by this point. Self-employed people, overwhelmingly what I guess in the US you would refer to as people who work for DoorDash or similar apps. He has a big support base there, a lot between industry and technology. But if we're going to sort of zoom out and look at a larger level, because obviously there's this point of view like, wow, Argentina is suddenly really ultra right. What happened? And I think it's more, like I said, it was more a question of not voting for a model that people consider is not working. And, you mentioned, we have 40% people living in poverty. Our year-on-year inflation is at 140%. It's, something isn't working, right? And so more generally, I think it speaks more to the fact that there is a huge discontent with our current political model and that our current political system has failed the country, basically. And it's more of a, I am sick and tired of this. I want something to change. And I think this also bears out by the fact that a lot of people who vote for him and that you see in interviews and even on social media, they don't actually agree with a lot of his policies, dollarizing the economy, opening an organ market, opening everything up to firearms and cutting off ties with Brazil. These aren't things that people in general agree with, but it's more of a, I'm sick and tired of this. Something needs to change.
Well, it certainly sounds like a lot of ingredients for upheaval, which is what I think we've just seen in Argentina. You mentioned some of his pronouncements, his promises on the campaign trail. Can you talk about some of the issues that he really highlighted as a candidate? What were some of the policies? Maybe we could start with his economic policies that really might have helped him gain traction among the voters there.
Yeah, I think so. When it comes to the economic side of things, his main proposal that he was really hammering home, like ever since he was, starting out on the campaign, was to dollarize the economy, right? This idea that, well, the peso, I mean, he likened it to excrement before one of the elections, because of course we had a presidential runoff as well as primary elections this year. It's been a busy voting year for Argentines. Before one of those rounds of elections, he actually said that the peso is excrement. No one should save in pesos. We need to dollarize the economy, dollarize the economy, dollarize the economy, and abolish the central bank, which would basically mean the Argentine peso, which is already, running away from us in terms, like in comparison to the US dollar, it would go up to approximately 9,000 pesos per dollar if we were to dollarize the economy. And abolishing the central bank would essentially mean we have no sovereignty when it comes to our exchange rate, right? Because we don't have our own, we wouldn't have our own national currency and we wouldn't have the ability to make decisions on that. However, what's been interesting since winning on November 19th is that he's really softening his tone on a lot of things. So he's come out and said shutting down the central bank is non-negotiable. We are going to shut down the central bank. But he's also apparently going to appoint an economy minister who would not go through with a dollarization proposal. And in fact, there have been several analysts saying, hey, the economy's calmed down a bunch since Milei apparently isn't going to go through with the dollarization. So one thing is the things that he's been saying in the campaign, which are extremely radical and extreme and frankly horrifying and concerning. And now even he hasn't even assumed yet the inauguration or the he's going to be officially president on December 10th, right? But he's already toning things down. And I think kind of looking at the playing field and things are being decided and very much, yeah, toned down. So I don't really know what's going to come to pass and what isn't.
Well, it makes sense. He maybe is trying to lower expectations a little bit now at this point. We're
Yeah,
talking about
yeah.
Argentina's far-right president-elect Javier Milei, and we're joined by Valen Eddie-Cibar, an award-winning journalist and editor at the Buenos Aires Herald. Well, Valen, I'm curious about the break with the past here, because a number of the listeners here may remember the movie Evita, Eva Perón, and the Perónism has been essentially in power in Argentina off and on since the 1940s. It's only the Perónism has only lost three presidential elections. It has won 10. And I'm just curious what Milei's policies represent in terms of a break with the past. Can you give us some context there?
Sure. I mean, I think it's interesting to say that they've been off and on in power in since the 40s, especially since at one point it was explicitly forbidden for Peronism to be a political movement. Perón was famously exiled. So yeah, and we've had military dictatorships since the 40s. Argentina had eight regime changes over the course of the 20th century. It's a very, it was a lot of
It's
upheaval.
checkered.
Yeah, oh my goodness. Because eight regime changes, from one military dictatorship to the next, to democracy, to a puppet cover, you know, it's fascinating. If anyone is into political science in the US and wants to take a look at Argentina, oh my goodness, you can spend a lifetime, and you can spend a lifetime talking about Peronismo, about Peronism as well. The thing is, when I think this idea of him being a break with the past is very much a discursive idea, because as in terms of discourse, because he's not really, I don't think, a substantial change or a substantial break from what we've been seeing politically, because he's very much, you know, he won the presidential runoff in large part because of support from former President Macri and Junto por el Cambio, which was a or is a coalition that is currently in total upheaval because of this pact that was made with Milei. It's quite a fascinating story. I don't know how much time we have to get into it, but it's basically a coalition that was an opposition coalition that imploded following, well, Milei's appearance on the scene and the former president allying himself with him. Even the, you know, the former candidate for Junto por el Cambio will now be his security minister. And she was previously under President Macri, who was not a Peronist, who did not have a Peronist government. She was his security minister, but she was also, you know, she's been in politics for well over 20 years now, and has gone through many a political strife. Her name is Patricia Bullrich, another very interesting character to look into in Argentine politics. So I think it's more voters wanting a change, but I'm not seeing beyond these really radical and extremist ideas that are being said, right, on social media and on his electoral platform, and really the threats to remove a lot of our rights. It's not really a break from the past in any substantial way, because the players that we're seeing being announced into his cabinet now are very familiar faces. And we're talking familiar faces from 20 years ago, not from 3 years ago. So it was definitely an anti-Peronist vote, especially because his entire campaign and the campaign of Junto por el Cambio, this other coalition, was very much focused on eliminating Kirchnerismo, which, I'm sorry, I know I'm throwing out a bunch of terms here, but it's basically a specific branch of Peronism of the current government. You know, the entire electoral platform was, we need to destroy this political movement, right? And so that's how it was very much portrayed, as a, we need to beat this political movement, which to me is honestly unacceptable as a electoral platform, because you can't really destroy a political movement, right? So I think in that sense, it's a break from the past, but you have to bear in mind that there's this government, but the one previously wasn't a Peronist government, and now it's mostly on paper. Hey, this is completely new. But when you start looking into the actual players and what they're actually going to be proposing, because as I said, we don't really know how much of his extremist sayings and, you know, statements will translate into actual policy, but it's more like, hey, we're saying we're doing these new things, but the people we're bringing in and what we're actually going to end up doing, probably not going to be that different.
Yeah, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, as the saying goes. So, in terms of terms that you're referencing, I guess I should ask you just to define briefly Peronism for those not familiar.
Peronism is such a difficult, it's kind of, I guess it would be kind of like saying define republicanism, or, you know, Democrats, you know what a Democrat is. Like, I don't, like, you can say what they are in two sentences, but like, can I really encapsulate everything that they are? And but Peronism is, I guess, when you talk about, when it's talked about in the media, it's a lot about like this center left coalition that was born from the Peronism movement, being Juan Domingo Perón, who was our president several times in the 20th century, famously exiled. But it's more, I would say it's very sort of socially focused. When you talk to people who vote for Peronism, it isn't so much, it's not just an idolatry of Perón and Evita, for anyone who is familiar with the musical, which I should say I haven't actually seen. I don't know. It came from two English guys visiting Buenos Aires once, like, all respect to Andrew Lloyd Webber, but as an Argentine, I'm like, I don't know if I need an English guy's take on my city and entire political history, because he came here for a week or two. But it's not just this idolatry of them as as people, or particularly their politics, is a very wide-ranging political platform. If you look at the history of Peronist leaders, they've been very different. When you talk to people who are Peronists, it's more they vote for the project, not the person. That's what they talk about a lot. And a lot of it is, of course, inspired in Evita. You know, there is a huge following of what she was, and very sort of focused on social justice and the poor and workers' rights. And there's obviously plenty to criticize, as with any political movement that's been in power for a while, but that's broadly.
No, I appreciate that. I'm trying to encapsulate a longstanding political movement. I appreciate that that summary. And just to talk more about Milei, one of his policy platforms is essentially denying climate change. He is known as El Loco, the madman, and has repeatedly also downplayed atrocities committed by security forces during the dictatorship. But I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about some of those positions, his positions on climate change, and maybe a bit about his sort of revisionist take on the dictatorship that Argentina suffered.
Sure. I mean, so when it comes to climate change, I feel actually that this electoral cycle, this election cycle, there wasn't that much talked about when it came to the climate crisis, which to me was interesting. But when it comes to climate change, yeah, absolutely, he denies it. And in one of the political debates, he referred to it as a post-Marxist agenda, as in it's not even, it's not real. It's like, oh, no, this is an imposition from the left, as he does with a lot of things. The left gets blamed for a lot of things. I think one of the most serious things that he's been doing, and specifically his vice president, Victoria Villarruel, is to deny, I wouldn't call her a military denialist. I would call her and them an apologist, because they don't deny the atrocities being committed under the dictatorship. They actively revindicate it and say, oh, there were excesses, but there was a left-wing guerrilla that had to be crushed, which is, when you look at the history of Argentina, for those who don't know, about 30,000 people were forcefully disappeared, tortured, and murdered by the last military dictatorship. And the dictatorship itself referred to it as a extermination plan. You know, it's not something that I don't think that they were particularly shy about, but they actively hid all of their war crimes. So 30,000 is a number that we don't actually know the full number. 30,000 is an estimate based on the numbers of people that we know went through these clandestine prisons and torture centers, which were truly horrific. The people that we know that were murdered, and we're finding out all the time. To this day, you know, we have a database that's run by grandmothers of children who were appropriated or adopted out to different military personnel and friends because they had murdered their parents. So it's an ongoing thing that's very painful, and it's something that we continue to live through to this day. And the reason why it's, I think, one of the more serious things that they have been sort of actively revindicating and sort of really trying to push this idea that, oh, it wasn't such a big deal, it's not real, because of course that's the key word here is disappeared, right? We don't exactly know. And so they try to say, oh, it wasn't 30,000. You can't really say that. Here are the actual numbers, which aren't true. But it's more about trying to undermine certain consensus that we've had and that we've built over the past 40 years as a democracy. Because again, bear in mind, we're a very young democracy in that sense, because it only came back in 1983. This 10th of December, we're turning 40 as a democracy. These are things that have very much been built within living memory, and that continues to be constructed. And the importance of memory, truth, and justice, as we say, continues to be highlighted and now fought for, because we have a vice president and a president that say, no, it wasn't that big a deal, it's not true, and actually we should be thanking them for doing that. You know, it's a very tough position to be in.
Yeah, it's a tough wound in that society. And I appreciate you explaining that. So if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar on Your Calls Media Roundtable. And we're talking about Argentina's far-right president-elect Javier Milei. We're joined by Valen Idizibar. And we are delving into what the impacts of this is going to be. And since it's Your Calls Media Roundtable, I wanted to ask you about the media side of this. The president-elect has pledged to shut down public journalism. How are the media covering his ascent to power? And does anything in particular concern you now as a journalist working in Argentina?
Yes. Full stop. That's it. We can move on to the next question. No, I'm joking. So yes, I, as a journalist, this is, I mean, there were already concerning signs even before he officially made it known that he wants to privatize and lay off a bunch of people from publicly owned, you know, state-owned news agencies. There's the fact that, for example, getting accredited as a foreign correspondent from any newspaper was virtually impossible for his campaign. I am from Argentina, and I don't cover Argentina as a foreign correspondent, but I know plenty. And they actually ended up having to put out a communique saying, hey, we're not being allowed to cover this. Disturbing things like his, he closed his campaign in a stadium and wouldn't allow people to film it. We're seeing situations where the videos that you see of him appearing on certain media outlets, the film, the actual video doesn't belong to the news station, but to his party, and then they will send it to the studio. So as a journalist already seeing these things happening, him over the years, because the media is in part responsible for his rise to prominence. We saw his violent outbursts against journalists. Like, this is something that is well known. So as president-elect, my future president within a couple of weeks, it's very concerning. When it comes to actually covering him, it's been interesting. It's been an interesting thing to see how certain media outlets have, especially after the general elections. So just to break it down real quick for any listeners who don't follow Argentine politics, which is fair enough, we have primary elections, we have the general election, and then if no one wins outright, we have a runoff, right? So this year we voted 3 times, and it's also mandatory for us to vote. So that's a lot of people voting a lot of times in 1 year. So he won in the primaries and then lost in the general round, in the general election. And that's when this other political force, this third party came in, this opposition coalition run by former president Mauricio Macri, who is now having a huge role in Milei's incoming government, sort of sweeps in, and they, you know, took a lot of votes for the presidential runoff in November. The reason I'm bringing this up is that media outlets that were traditionally aligned with Macri was suddenly making Milei seem a whole lot more palatable, or, you know, running certain stories or certain lines that were in agreement with what Milei is saying, which is it was a very, as a journalist, watching the chips fall in that way, sort of from him going from being a sort of loose cannon, quirky, eccentric pundit that you bring on to bring up your ratings because he yells at people and is kind of, well, except, let's say eccentric, but he's sort of violent and walks around wielding a chainsaw, as you so aptly pointed out, to, well, tear him out. Or let's see this. What is really going on here? This week, one of them spread fake news claiming that 50 Shades of Grey had been assigned in a schoolroom, in a school classroom, in a bid to undermine and to speak ill of a sex education law that we have here. And I mention it because I think this is going to be familiar to a lot of US listeners, right? This sort of fear mongering of, oh, but you're indoctrinating the kids, right? And this is something that was something almost exclusively a Milei thing and his party and coalition discourse that's now being replicated in the media. And then other media outlets have obviously been very vocal in speaking out against him. The Herald, you know, at the Herald, we sat down as a newsroom and we collectively wrote an editorial saying we consider him to be a threat to Argentina, which is one of, I think, one of my proudest moments as a journalist. Say, hey, I'm in a newsroom where we can all like look at each other in the eye and say, hey, what are we feeling about this? What do we consider to be the important thing when it comes to this election? And what do we want to communicate to our readers? So it's definitely been, you know, a wide-ranging reaction when it comes to the media. But I do, as a journalist, consider that there are certain actors that a few years down the line, we're going to remember what they were doing at this time, mm-hmm. because it's been honestly frustrating. And I'm sure any of, you know, your listeners can appreciate how frustrating it is to see those things start to play out, and you can see where it's going and you don't want them to do it. And yet, and they did it and they said that, and they went there, you know?
Yeah. Well, Valen, one thing we haven't talked about is some of his social policies, where he is, for example, on issues of LGBTQ rights, which I know is an issue you cover at the Buenos Aires Herald, also his position on abortion. What about some of these social issues?
Well, yeah, I mean, I cover LGBTQIA issues, and I am also a trans person. So it's sort of a double whammy there when it comes to being very concerned about what's coming, not just on a personal level, but more looking around at my community and to seeing, oh my goodness, this is what's going to happen. This is what's being threatened, right? So when it comes specifically to the queer community, to the LGBTQIA community, there's this line of, because he and his coalition define themselves as libertarians, right? So there's this idea that you can do whatever you want. As an individual, you have your rights, but they're also socially extremely conservative. As you said, they want to get rid of the abortion law, right? Sort of put it to a vote, see what happens. So there's very much a line of, we're not homophobic, we're not transphobic, but they do a lot of things that enable hateful people to attack the queer community. And there's been a huge uptick in threats being made by people who are explicitly from this coalition towards people of the queer community. He wants to abolish, as you said in your introduction, he wants to abolish a lot of ministries, which includes the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Women and Diversities, Women, Gender and Diversities, which again would have a huge impact on the LGBTQIA community, not only because there is a specific ministry that is dedicated to issues of gender-based violence, but also when you talk about public health, if you are suffering from HIV/AIDS and you do not have access to public health care, that is a death sentence. So it's kind of a global concern when it comes to that, because it would just have such a wide ranging effect that would have such a huge human cost when it comes to his so-called social policies.
It sounds like a very fraught time, and I appreciate you explaining what's happening from Argentina and this far right president-elect Javier Milei. We'll see what happens as he gets sworn into power. But Valen Irizibar, thank you so much. Award-winning journalist, editor at the Buenos Aires Herald. Really appreciate you coming on and giving us some insights about what's happening in Argentina.
It's a joy to be on KLW again. I'm just sorry that it's in these circumstances, but thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Always wonderful to have you back. And coming up next, we're going to talk about upcoming cases that the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing. So stay with us after this short break. Welcome back. For those of you just joining now, I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can always drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And for this next segment on the U.S. Supreme Court and the cases that the court will be hearing in this upcoming next few months in the term here, we want to hear from you. And we're opening the phone lines. Are you following any particular U.S. Supreme Court cases? Do you have any thoughts about ethics and the Supreme Court? We'd love to hear from you. The conversation to join it is you can call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. We'd love to have you join this conversation. So now we're going to discuss the important U.S. Supreme Court cases that have been heard so far, as well as the upcoming ones. So this year, the court is hearing several hot button cases, including gun rights, free speech, abortion, voting rights, and more. So to get the latest, we're so pleased to be joined once again by Chris Geidner, an award-winning legal journalist and author and publisher of Law Dork, a newsletter that covers the Supreme Court law and politics. He also contributes to Grid and Bolts and previously worked as the Supreme Court correspondent and legal editor at BuzzFeed News, as well as for The Appeal and Metro Weekly. So Chris, great to have you back on the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
So, Chris, we had you on back in October when the court had just begun this 2023-2024 term, and a lot's happened in the past nearly 2 months. So can you give us just a sort of high-level take now about what direction the court is taking? Anything surprising that stood out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think just before we get into it, want to highlight for your listeners, it is actually quite an important day to think about sort of the longer context of the court and the big picture, because Justice Sandra Day O'Connor died this morning at 93 years old, and she obviously had a nearly 25-year tenure on the court where a lot changed. And yet it is in those years since she left, and then since the second woman on the court, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, left, that we've seen much more rapid change, including the overturning of some of the key precedents that she had voted to reaffirm, like Roe versus Wade and like affirmative action. So I just want to sort of contextualize what we're talking about today in the context of O'Connor's time on the court and of the past 50 years.
Absolutely. I appreciate you mentioning that. That is, you know, essentially breaking news, and I appreciate you bringing that up. And absolutely, both Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor, I mean, replaced by far more conservative justices that have really sort of turned the page on that era that they represented. And there's also some other breaking news, which I do want to talk about. Of course, we have a lot to cover with the court cases, but the House of Representatives, of course, today just voted to expel Representative George Santos. I know this is not part of the Supreme Court beat, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the politics of this and any potential legal implications.
Yeah, I think it is notable that even today's vote to expel him was not a majority of Republicans. I think the Republicans were 105 to 112 against expelling him, and all but two of the Democrats voted to expel him. So, I mean, he was expelled handily, but even on his expulsion, a majority of the Republicans, including the leadership, did not support his expulsion. So I think that is the context that I'm trying to keep front and center on that issue. But now we have a House, as the speaker said, of 434 members and not 435.
They do have a razor thin Republican majority.
Yeah.
And so I can see why
was clearly supporting him.
One of those few votes. I think he had maybe five votes to spare. So what's the process now to replace Santos?
For House members, it's a special election. So that seat will be vacant until there can be a special election. Senate appointments. I don't know what the New York specific procedures are, but generally it's the governor has to call a special election or to hold it on the next regular election. And I believe since New York's primaries, I believe, aren't until September, I would think it's almost certain that there will be a special election here.
So we'll have to pay attention to those results, because that will really affect this razor thin majority that Republicans have.
Yeah, if it goes from Republican to Democrat, that would I mean, right now it's gone from Republican to nobody. But if it went from Republican to nobody to Democrat, you'd effectively lose two votes in that close vote count.
Yeah, we'll say what you will about this Republican majority. It's definitely not boring. They keep this quite interesting with the candidates that they run and their internal upheaval. I did want to ask about another bit of somewhat breaking news. Yesterday, Democrats in the Judiciary Subcommittee voted to subpoena conservative mega donor Harlan Crow and far-right activist Leonard Leo. This relates to some of the scandals reported on by ProPublica, revealing that those two men had played a role in taking conservative justices Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito on luxury vacations. And then you had the Republican members of the committee essentially walk out in response to that subpoena. And this, of course, relates to your beat on the Supreme Court and the ethics scandal there. Do you think there is going to be any meaningful movement on this front, given this sort of partisan paralysis on the Senate Judiciary Committee? What's the prospect for any sort of congressional oversight over Supreme Court ethics?
I mean, I think it's clear from the House leadership that there's not going to be legislation that's passed. And that is why I think the Senate Judiciary Committee and Chair Durbin, Dick Durbin of Illinois, who I have regularly questioned aspects of his leadership, but I think that he has smartly, in this instance, made the decision that it is important for the committee to do what it is able to do when he is aware that there are limits on what actual legislation is going to be able to be passed because of the Republican leadership in the House. And so the focus is on what can we look into now so that we can devise legislation, craft legislation that will be able to address this going forward. Now, the Republican response is, it's not even that. You don't have any legislation you're doing. This is just an attack on these people because of decisions you don't like. Now, if there hadn't been 20,000 words of stories from ProPublica over the course of this year detailing why it's not just politics, that might hold more water. But the fact is that there are real legitimate questions about both Justice Alito and Justice Thomas's behavior, as well as the forthrightness of other justices' practices. That show that the voluntary nature of even this new Supreme Court code of conduct that the justices recently announced is likely insufficient to guarantee that there is any real check on the justices' behavior. And I think we've talked before about the fact that we consider it normal that there is oversight of the executive branch from Congress. And to the extent that people criticize Democratic's investigation of the Supreme Court now as being inappropriate because it's a separate branch of government, that's completely ignoring the sort of congressional oversight that is the bread and butter of what Congress does.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you recognizing ProPublica and the thoroughness of their work in uncovering some of these scandals, and a good reminder of why we do Your Call Media Roundtable, which listeners are listening to right now. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar on today's program, and we're pleased to be joined by Chris Geidner, award-winning legal journalist and author and publisher of Law Dork, covering politics and the Supreme Court. So, Chris, I do want to delve into some of the recent cases at the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
One involving the SEC. Can you talk about that case and the oral arguments?
Yeah, the Securities and Exchange Commission has both administrative and it has authority to enforce the law either through administrative agency enforcement or by going to court. And this has been the case. This has been the case since the savings and loan scandal, and then their authority was expanded after the Great Recession in 2008. And the challenge that was brought here is one of three challenges that the court is hearing this term that could really dramatically upend the way both the power of agencies to act and, even going a step further, the power of Congress to choose what authority it wants to give agencies to act, which I think shows sort of how extreme this is getting. We're not just talking about like presidential power and agencies and administrative state, the sort of things that you've heard about sort of the Federalist Society opposing in the past. This is going a step further. And we already heard a case earlier this year about the authority of Congress when setting the spending mechanisms, in that case for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And now this case with about the SEC is about its administrative law judges, their authority, and then the issue that we were discussing that the justices and the lawyers were debating in court on Wednesday, which is the Seventh Amendment right to a civil jury trial in civil lawsuits. And there was a lot of discussion about what rights to a civil jury trial there were back in the time of the Seventh Amendment in England, back in 1791. As I wrote at Law Dork, it was one of those arguments. And the ultimate question comes down to there was an earlier Supreme Court case, Atlas Roofing, in which, as Justice Kagan said, if you look at the decision in that case, you look at the questions before the court this week, the answer is sort of done. The question has been decided, and that's this idea that if Congress is passing a new law that creates a new right of action, a new ability of the government to enforce something, it's what's referred to as a public right. There's some governmental interest there that is trying to be enforced, that if that is what the agency is enforcing, there's no Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial, because obviously that didn't exist in 1791. Now, what the challenger in this case is saying is that, well, securities fraud, which is what is at issue here, is really similar to common law fraud, really similar to the type of fraud that you could have brought in as a lawsuit under common law back in 1791. And so because of that, Mr. Jarchese's lawyer is arguing this SEC enforcement has to be in court. It can't mm-hmm. be an administrative law judge. And while there are some broader implications, and they could sort of upend the appointment of administrative law judges, they could say that Congress doesn't have the ability to delegate this authority. It seemed that the justices were very focused on this finding what I said at Law Dork passes for a compromise in this era of sort of a narrow decision that has to do with securities fraud claims specifically and their similarity to common law fraud claims. Mm-hmm. Now, Justices Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Jackson, pretty strongly argued, well, no, it's still completely different. It's not like common law fraud. There are different elements that you have to prove. And again, it's this public interest of the government feeling like common law fraud isn't enough, and that mm-hmm. you need some government enforcement in order to protect the public from these harms of market manipulation. And so they argue that it's a different crime. It's a different issue. It's a different issue, not a crime. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Yeah. That would solve that. It's a different issue, and the government should be allowed to bring that in a forum that doesn't require a jury trial. I don't think they're going to win, but yeah, I do think we're going to avoid the broadest sort of upending of the ability of Congress to pass any sorts of these sort of administrative agency enforcement actions.
Well, I guess given the stakes, it certainly could have gone worse based on what we sounds like you heard at oral argument.
That's sort of our glass half full version these days.
Which is pretty common.
It could have gone worse.
Pretty common to have to use the glass half full when you're looking at this particular court here. I want to ask about another case regarding the U.S. tax code as a potential to reshape it, Moore versus the United States. Can you talk about this case?
Yeah, this is next week's case, and this is a case that thus far a lot of the public discussion has been about whether Justice Alito should even be hearing the case. This is a case where, if you remember, over the past year, Justice Alito has sat down repeatedly with the Wall Street Journal for interviews, basically defending his narrative of we're being attacked because of our positions and cases and not actually because of ethics. And one of the people who he sat for those interviews with is actually one of the lawyers on this case. And so there was a call for him to recuse himself from the case. He's already issued a statement saying that he's not going to recuse and why. So it looks like he's going to be on the case. But what the case is really again, another one of these cases that could dramatically upend the way that the government works. And it's whether the 16th Amendment authorizes Congress to tax unrealized sums without apportionment among the states. Basically, if you are the idea of can an income tax include taxes on what is referred to as unrealized income. And this is a question that comes up in this case related to a very specific sub-issue about the Moors, who have an interest in a foreign business, a foreign operated business, and whether or not profits from that business are to be assessed against their taxes right now. But it has large implications for things like a wealth tax, and can also have lots of implications for other areas of tax that have really been in place since the 16th Amendment was passed. And the question of whether or not the Supreme Court should be deciding that this phrase that does not appear in the 16th Amendment about unrealized sums should just be impermissible under the income tax, or whether or not that's a policy decision for Congress to make is really ultimately what's at issue in this case. And that's why the day after the Supreme Court announced they were going to hear this case, the Wall Street Journal had an editorial saying, thank goodness they're taking this case. We need this to be resolved because people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders want a wealth tax. Mm-hmm.
So it seems like they're trying to use the court here to try to thwart their leftist rival policy goals. And just want to remind listeners, we're talking to Chris Geidner, award-winning legal journalist and author and publisher of Law Dork, a newsletter that covers the Supreme Court, law, and politics. Chris, I also wanted to ask you about upcoming cases here. We've covered a couple of these issues now in some depth, but I know that the court has cases related to gun rights, free speech, contraceptive abortion pills, transgender rights. What are you looking at now coming up on the docket?
Yeah, a lot of those that you just said are things that they haven't even decided whether they're going to hear yet. The gun rights case, obviously, they did hear one of them, Rahimi, about whether the federal ban on gun possession by people with domestic violence restraining orders, that was heard, and it did appear that the court is going to uphold that federal law. But there's another issue. Everything else that you've talked about is currently either before the justices through a request for a writ of certiorari, so for the court to basically grant the case and hear it on the merits, or even in the case of there's a new gun rights case on the shadow docket out of Illinois, Illinois' ban on assault weapons. The challengers to that law went to the court. I've lost track of time. It was either yesterday or Wednesday, and have asked the court to put a Seventh Circuit ruling on hold that would allow that Illinois ban to go into effect. The other cases that you mentioned, there is this question about mifepristone, the medication abortion, and that is before the justices. The Fifth Circuit, the most conservative appeals court, issued a ruling partially in favor of challengers to mifepristone, not its overall approval, but changes that ease the access to medication abortion since 2016. And the Justice Department and the maker of that drug, Mifeprex, Danko Laboratories, have asked the Supreme Court to hear the case. And so that's before the justices. They also have a case out of Indiana about a school district's policy banning transgender students from using the restroom that meets with their gender identity. And
Chris, I hate to cut you off, but we're just about out of time. I appreciate you running through these cases. This court is not boring either. There's a lot to cover as well.
All of them, the justices are going to be deciding whether to hear these cases between now and January, probably.
So we'll have to have you back on to get the latest. But Chris Geidner, award-winning legal journalist, author, and publisher of Law Dork, thank you so much for joining us on Your Call.
Thank you.
So to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, and you can give us a review there. You can also email us show ideas and any feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and it's Your Call.